From PRI, Public Radio International.
My father is 86 years old and in bed. Sitting on one pillow, leaning on three, he offers last-minute advice and makes a request. "I would like you to write a simple story just once more," he says. "The kind Maupassant wrote, or Chekhov, the kind you used to write. Just recognizable people, and then write down what happened to them next." I say, "Yes, why not?"
You're listening to Ann Pitoniak reading Grace Paley's classic story, A Conversation with My Father. You'll be hearing the complete story later on today's edition of Selected Shorts, a series that originates in live performance on stage at Symphony Space in New York City. I'm Isaiah Sheffer. Pick a pair of perfect Paleys. That's the recipe for this program of Selected Shorts. The late Grace Paley, winner of the Ray Award for the short story, can be said to have been the founding mother of our series. In the years that followed Grace's first appearance at Selected Shorts, she remained a great friend of our literary endeavors, hosting short story evenings and urging recommendations to us of new and still unsung writers, some of them her students. Grace influenced a generation of young writers in New York and at the Provincetown Fine Arts Workshop. Let's listen now as Laura Esterman reads the fantastical Paley account of a meeting with the people who now live in her old apartment, the long-distance runner.
One day, before or after 42, I became a long-distance runner. Though I was stout and in many ways inadequate to this desire, I wanted to go far and fast, not as fast as bicycles and trains, not as far as Taipei, Hingwen, places like that. Islands of the slant-eyed, as sailors in bus stations say when speaking of travel, but round and round the county, from the seaside to the bridges, along the old neighborhood streets a couple of times, before old age and urban renewal ended them and me. I tried the country first. Connecticut, which, being wooded, is always full of buds in spring. All creation is secret. Isn't that true? So I trained in the wide-zoned suburban hills where I wasn't known. I ran all spring in and out of dogwood bloom, then laurel. People sometimes stopped and asked me why I ran, a lady in silk shorts halfway down over her fat thighs. "In training," I replied, and rested. Only to answer if closely questioned. I wore a white sleeveless undershirt as well, with excellent support, not to attract the attention of old men and prudish children. Then summer came. My legs seemed strong. I kissed the kids goodbye. They were quite old by then. It was near the time for parting anyway. I told Mrs. Raftery to look in now and then and give them some of that rotten Celtic supper she makes. I told them they could take off anytime they wanted to. "Go lead your private life," I said, "only leave me out of it." "A word to the wise," said Richard. "You're depressed, Faith," Mrs. Raftery said. "Your boyfriend, Jack, the one you think so hotsy-totsy, hasn't called, and you're as gloomy as a tick on Sunday." "Cut the folks with me, Raftery," I muttered. Her eyes filled with tears, because that's who she is, folks. From bunion to topknot. That's how she got liked by me, loved, invented, and endured. When I walked out the door, they were all reclining before the television set, Richard, Tonto, and Mrs. Raftery gazing at the news, which proved, with moving pictures, that there had been a voyage to the moon, and Africa and South America hid in a furious whirl of clouds. I said, "Bye." They said, "Yeah, okay, sure." "If that's how it is, forget it," I hollered, and took the independent subway to Brighton Beach. At Brighton Beach, I stopped at the Salty Breeze's locker room to change my clothes. 25 years ago, my father invested $500 in its future. In fact, he still clears about $3.50 a year, which goes directly, by law, to the children of Judea to cover their deficit. No one paid too much attention when I started to run easy and light on my feet. I ran on the boardwalk first, past my mother's leafleting station, between a soft ice cream stand and a degenerated dune. There she had been assigned by her comrades to halt the tides of cruel American enterprise with simple socialist sense. I wanted to stop and admire the long beach. I wanted to stop in order to think admiringly about New York. There aren't many rotting cities so tan and sandy and speckled with citizens at their salty edges. But I had already spent a lot of life lying down or standing and staring. I had decided to run. After about a mile and a half, I left the boardwalk and began to trot into the old neighborhood. I was running well. My breath was long and deep. I was thinking pridefully about my form. Suddenly, I was surrounded by about 300 blacks. Who are you? Who that? Look at her, just look. When you seen a fat ass? Poor thing, she ain't right. Leave her, you boys, you bad boys. I used to live here, I said. Oh, yes, they said, in the white old days, that time too bad to last. But we loved it here. We never went to Flatbush Avenue or Times Square. We loved our block. Tough black titty. I like your speech, I said. Metaphor and all. Right on. We get that from talking. Yes, my people also had a way of speech. And don't forget the Irish, the gift of gab. Who they, said a small boy. Cops. Nowadays, I suggested, there's more than Irish on the police force. You right, said two ladies. More, much, much more. These French, Chinamen, Ruskies, Congolians, oh ho, missy, you two right. I lived in that house, I said. That apartment house all my life, till I got married. Now that is nice, live in one place. My mother lived that way in South Carolina, one place. Her daddy farmed, she said. They ate, no matter winter, war, bad times, Roosevelt. Something. Ain't that wonderful? And it weren't cold, big trees. That apartment. I looked up and pointed. There, the third floor. They all looked up. So what, you blubberous devil, said a dark young man. He wore horn-rimmed glasses and had that intelligent look that city college boys used to have when I was 18 and first looked at them. He seemed to lead them in contempt and anger, even the littlest ones, who moved toward me with dramatic stealth. Singing devil, oh, devil. I don't think the little kids had bad feeling because they poked a finger into me, then laughed. Still, I thought it might be wise to keep my head, so I jumped right in with some facts. I said, how many flowers' names do you know? Wildflowers, I mean. My people only knew two. That's what they say now, anyway. Rich or poor, they only had two flowers' names, Rose and Violet. Daisy, said one boy immediately. Weed, said another. That is a flower, I thought, but everyone else got the joke. Saxifrage, lupine, said a lady. Viper's bugloss, said a small Girl Scout. In medium green with a dark green sash, she held up a handbook of wild flowers. How many you know, fat mama? A boy asked warmly. He wasn't against my being a mother or fat. I turned all my attention to him. Oh, sonny, I said. I'm way ahead of my people. I know. In yellows alone, common cinquefoil, trout lily, yellow adder's tongue, swamp buttercup and common buttercup, golden sorrel, yellow or hop clover, devil's paintbrush, evening primrose, black-eyed Susan, golden aster, also the yellow pickerel weed growing down by the water, if not in the water, and dandelions, of course. I've seen all these myself, seen them. You could see China from the boardwalk, a boy said, when it's nice. I know more flowers than countries. Mostly young people these days have traveled in many countries. Not me, I've been nowhere. Not me either, said about 17 boys. I'm not allowed, said a little girl. There's drunken junkies. But I, cried out a tall black youth, very handsome and well-dressed. I am an African. My father came from the high stolen plains. I have been everywhere. I was in Moscow 6 months learning machinery. I was in France learning French. I was in Italy observing the peculiar Renaissance and the people's sweetness. I was in England, where I studied the common law and the urban blight. I was at the Conference of Dark Youth in Cuba to understand our passion. I am now here. Here am I to become an engineer and return to my people around the Cape of Good Hope in a Norwegian sailing vessel. In this way, I will learn the fine old art of sailing in case the engines of the new society of my old inland country should fail. We had an extraordinary amount of silence after that. Then one old lady in a black dress and high white lace collar said to another old lady dressed exactly the same way, glad tidings when someone's got brains in the head, not fish juice. Amen, said a few. Why don't you go up to Mrs. Luddy living in your house, your lady, huh? The Girl Scout asked this. Why, she just grooved to see you, said some sarcastic snickerer. She got palpitations. Her man, he give it to her. That ain't all. He a natural gift giver. I'll take you, said the Girl Scout. My name is Cynthia. I'm in Troop 355 Brooklyn. I'm not dressed, I said, looking at my lumpy knees. You shouldn't wear no undershirt like that without no running number or no team writ on it. It looked like an undershirt. Cynthia, don't take her up there, said an important boy. Her head's strange. Don't you take her here? Lawrence, she said softly. You tell me once more what to do, I'll wrap you around that lamppost. Git, she said, powerfully addressing me. In this way, I was led into the hallway of the whole house of my childhood. The first door I saw was still marked in flaky gold 1A. That's where the janitor lived, I said. He was a Negro. How come like that? Cynthia made an astonished face. How come the janitor was a black man? Oh, Cynthia, I said. Then I turned to the opposite door, first floor front, 1B. Huh, I remembered. Now, here, this was Mrs. Gorodisky, very, very fat lady. All her children died at birth. Born, then, 1, 2, 3, dead. 5 children. Then Mr. Gorodisky said, I'm bad luck on you, Tessie, and he went away. He sent $15 a week for 7 years, then no one heard. I know her. Poor thing, said Cynthia. The city come for her summer before last. The way they knew, it smelled. They wrapped her up in a canvas. They couldn't get through the front door. It scraped off a piece of her. My Uncle Ronald had to help them, but he got disgusted. Only 2 years ago she was still here? Wasn't she scared? So we all, said Cynthia, white ain't everything. Who lived up here, she asked. 2B. Right now my best friend Nancy Rosalind lives here. She got 2 brothers and her sister married and got a baby. She very light skinned, not her mother. We got all colors amongst us. Your best friend? That's funny, because it was my best friend right in that apartment, Joanna Rosen. What become of her, Cynthia asked. She got a running shirt, too? Come on, Cynthia. If you really want to know, I'll tell you. She married this man, Marvin Stiers. Who's he? I recollected his achievements. Well, he's the president of a big corporation, Jomar Plastics. This corporation owns a steel company, a radio station, a new Xerox type machine that lets you do 25 different pages at once. This corporation has a foundation, the Jomar Fund for Research in Conservation. Capitalism is like that, I added, in order to be politically useful. How come you know? You go over their house a lot? No. I happened to read all about them on the financial page just last week. It made me think, a different life? That's all. Different spokes for different folks, said Cynthia. I sat down on the cool marble steps and remembered Joanna's cousin, Ziggy. He was older than we were. He wrote a poem which told us we were lovely flowers and our legs were petals, which nature would force open no matter how many times we said no. Then I had several other interior thoughts that I couldn't share with a child, the kind that give your face a blank or melancholy look. Now you're not interested, said Cynthia. Now you're not going to say a thing. Who lived here? 2A, who? Two men lives here now. Women coming, women going. My mother says, danger sign, stay away, my darling, stay away. I don't remember, Cynthia, I really don't. You got to. What you come for, anyways? Then I tried 2A. 2A, was it the twins? I felt a strong obligation, as though remembering was in charge of the existence of the past. This is not so. Cynthia, I said, I don't want to go any further. I don't even want to remember. Come on, she said, tugging at my shorts. Don't you want to see Mrs. Luddy, the one who lives in your old house? That'd be fun, no? No, no, I don't want to see Mrs. Luddy. Now, you shouldn't pay no attention to those boys downstairs. She will like you. I mean, she is kind. She don't like most white people, but she might like you. No, Cynthia, it's not that, but I don't want to see my father and mother's house now. I didn't know what to say. I said, because my mother's dead. This was a lie, because my mother lives in her own room with my father in the Children of Judea. With her hand over her socialist heart, she reads the paper every morning after breakfast. Then she says, sadly, to my father, every day the same, dying, dying, dying from killing. My mother's dead, Cynthia. I can't go in there. Oh. Oh, the poor thing, she said, looking into my eyes. Oh, if my mother died, I don't know what I'd do. Even if I was old as you, I could kill myself. Tears filled her eyes and started down her cheeks. If my mother died, what would I do? She is my protector. She won't let the pushers get me. She hold me tight. She's gonna hide me in the cedar box if my Uncle Rudford comes try to get me back. She can't die, my mother. Cynthia, honey, she won't die. She's young. I put my arm out to comfort her. You could come and live with me, I said. I got two boys. They're nearly grown up. I missed it, not having a girl. What? What do you mean now, live with you and boys? She pulled away and ran for the stairs. Stay away from me, honky lady. I know them white boys. They're just going to try and jostle my black womanhood. My mother told me about that. Keep you white honky devil boys to your devil self. You just leave me be, you old b- you. Somebody help me, she started to scream. You hear? Somebody help. She's going to take me away. She flattened herself to the wall, trembling. I was too frightened by her fear of me to say, honey, I wouldn't hurt you. It's me. I heard her helpers, the voices of large boys crying, we coming, we coming, hold your head up, we coming. I ran past her fear to the stairs and up them, two at a time. I came to my old own door. I knocked. like the landlord, loud and terrible. "Mama, not home," a child's voice said. "No, no," I said. "It's me, a lady. Someone's chasing me. Let me in." "Mama, not home. I ain't allowed to open up for nobody. It's me," I cried out in terror. "Mama! Mama, let me in!" The door opened. A slim woman, whose age I couldn't invent, looked at me. She said, "Get in," and shut that door tight. She took a hard, pinching hold on my upper arm. Then she bolted the door herself. "Them hustlers after you, they make me pink. Hide this white lady now, Donald. Stick onto your bed. You got a high bed." "Oh, that's okay. I'm fine now," I said. I felt safe and at home. "You in my house," she said, "you do as I say. For 2 cents, I'll throw you out." I squatted under a small kid's pee mattress. Then I heard the knock. It was tentative and respectful. "My mama don't allow me to open." "Donald," someone called. "Donald!" "Oh, no," he said. "Can't do it. She's going to wear me out. You know her. She already tore up my ass this morning once. Ain't going to open up." I lived there for about 3 weeks with Mrs. Luddy. And Donald. And 3 little baby girls, nearly the same age. I told her a joke about Irish twins. "Ain't Irish," she said. Nearly every morning, the babies woke us at about 6:45. We gave them all a bottle and went back to sleep till 8. I made coffee, and she changed diapers. Then it really stank for a while. At this time, I usually said, "Well, listen, thanks, really, but I've got to go, I guess. I guess I'm going." She'd usually say, "Well, guess again. I guess you ain't." Or if she was feeling disgusted, she'd say, "Go on now, get. You want to go? I guess by now I have snorted enough white lady stink to choke a horse. Go on." I'd get to the door, and then I'd hear voices. I'm ashamed to say I'd become fearful. Despite my wide geographical love of mankind, I would be attacked by local fears. There was a sentimental truth that lay beside all that going and not going. It was my house, where I'd lived long ago, my family life. There was a tile on the bathroom floor that I myself had broken, dropping a hammer on the toe of my brother Charles as he stood dreamily shaving his halfway up his undershorts. Astonishment and knowledge first seized me right there. The kitchen was the same. The table was the enameled table common to our class, easy to clean, with wooden undercorners for indigent and old cockroaches that couldn't make it to the kitchen sink. However, it was not the same table, because I have inherited that one, chips and all. The living room was something like ours, only we had less plastic. There may have been less plastic in the world at that time. Also, my mother had set beautiful cushions everywhere, on beds and chairs. It was the way she expressed herself artistically, to embroider at night or take strips of flowered cotton and sew them across ordinary white or blue muslin in the most delicate designs, the way women have always used materials that live and die in hunks and tatters to say, "This is my place." Mrs. Luddy said, "Mm-hmm." Of course, I said men don't have that outlet. That's how come they run around so much. "Till they drunk enough to lay down," she said. "Yes," I said. "On a large scale, you can see it in the world. First they make something, then they murder it. Then they write a book about how interesting it is." "You got something there," she said. "Sometimes," she said, "girl, you don't know nothing." We often sat at the window, looking out and down. Little tufts of breeze grew on that windowsill. The blazing afternoon was around the corner and up the block. "You say, man," she said. "Is that man?" she asked. "What you call a man?" 4 flights below us, leaning on the stoop, were about a dozen people, and around them, devastation. "Just a minute," I said. I had seen devastation on my way, running, gotten some of the pebbles of it in my running shoe and the dust of it in my eyes. I had thought with the indignant courtesy of a citizen, this is a disgrace to the city of New York, which I love and am running through. But now, from the commanding heights of home, I saw it clearly. The tenement in which Jack, my old and present friend, had come to gloomy manhood, had been destroyed. First by fire, then by demolition, which is a swinging ball of steel that cracks bedrooms and kitchens. Because of this work, we could see several blocks wide and a block and a half long. That weird guy, Eddie, his house still stood, famous 1510. Gutted, with black window frames, no glass, open laths, the stubbornness of the supporting beams. Some persons or families still lived on the lowest floors. In the lots between, a couple of old sofas lay on their fat faces, their springs sticking up into the air. Just as in wartime, a half dozen ailanthus trees had already found their first quarter inch of earth and begun a living attack on the dead yards. At night, I knew animals roamed the place, squalling and howling, furious New York dogs and street cats and mighty rats. You'd think you were in Bear Mountain Park, the terror of venturing forth. Someone ought to clean that up, I said. Mrs. Luddy said, who you got in mind? Mrs. Kennedy? Donald made a stern face. He said, that's just what I'm going to do when I get big. Going to get the sanitary man in and show it to him. You see that, you big guinea, you? You clean it up right now. Then he stamped his feet and fierced his eyes. Mrs. Luddy said, come here, you little n-. She kissed the top of his head and gave him a whack on the backside all at one time. Well, said Donald, encouraged. Look out there now, y'all. Go on, I say. Look. Though we had already seen, to please him, we looked. On the stoop, men and boys lounged, leaned, hopped about, stood on one leg, then another, took their socks off and scratched their toes, talked, sat on their haunches, heads down, dozing. Donald said, look at them. They ain't got self-respect. They got afros on their heads, but they don't know they black in their heads. I thought he ought to learn to be more sympathetic. I said, there are reasons that people are that way.
Yes, ma'am, said Donald.
Anyway, how come you never go down and play with the other kids? How come you're up here so much? My mama don't like me do that. Some of them is bad. Bad. I might become a dope addict. I got to stay clear.
You just a dope.
That's a fact, said Mrs. Luddy. He ought to be with kids his age more, I think. He see them in school, miss. Don't trouble your head about it, if you don't mind. Actually, Mrs. Luddy didn't go down into the street either. Donald did all the shopping. She let the welfare investigator in. The meter man came into the kitchen to read the meter. I saw him from the back room where I hid. She did pick up her check. She cashed it. She returned to wash the babies, change their diapers, wash clothes, iron, feed people, and then, in free half hours, she sat by that window. She was waiting. I believed she was watching and waiting for a particular man. I wanted to discuss this with her, talk lovingly like sisters, but before I could freely say, forget about that son of a bitch, he's a pig, I did have to offer a few solid facts about myself, my kids, about fathers, husbands, passers-by, evening companions, and the life of my father and mother in this room by this exact afternoon window. I told her, for instance, that in my worst times, I had given myself one extremely simple physical pleasure. This was cream cheese for breakfast. In fact, I insisted on it, sometimes depriving the children of very important articles and food. Girl, you don't know nothing, she said. Then for a little while she talked gently as one does to a person who is innocent and insane and incorruptible because of stupidity. She had had two such special pleasures for hard times, she said. The first, men. But they turn rotten. White women had ruined the best, given them the idea that made of solid gold. The second pleasure she had tried was wine. She said, I do like wine. You has to have something just for yourself, by yourself. Then she said, but you can't raise a decent boy when you lick a dazed every night. White or black, I said, returning to the men. They did think they were bringing a rare gift, whereas it was just sex, which is common, like bread, though essential. Oh, you can do without, she says. There's folks do without. I told her Donald deserved the best. I loved him. If he had flaws, I hardly noticed them. It's one of my beliefs that children do not have flaws. Even the worst do not. Donald was brilliant, like my boys, except he had an easier disposition. For this reason, I decided almost the second moment of my residence in that household to bring him up to reading level, at once. I told him we would work with books and newspapers. He went immediately to his neighborhood library and brought some hard books to amuse me, Black Folk Tales by Julius Lester and The Pushcart War, which is about another neighborhood, but relevant. Donald always agreed with me when we talked about reading and writing. In fact, when I mentioned poetry, he told me he knew all about it. That David Henderson, a known black poet, had visited his second grade class. So Donald was, as it turned out, well ahead of my nosy tongue. He was usually very busy shopping. He also had to spend a lot of time making faces to force the little serious baby girls into laughter. But if the subject came up, he could take the poem right out of the air into which language and event had just gone. An example, that morning his mother had said, phew, I just got too much piss and diapers and wash. I want to just sit down by that window and rest myself. He wrote a poem. Just got too much pissy diapers and wash and wash. Just want to sit down by that window and look out. Ain't nothing there. Donald, I said, you are plain brilliant. I'm never going to forget you. For God's sakes, don't you forget me. You fool with him too much, said Mrs. Luddy. He already don't even remember his grandma. You never going to meet someone like her. A curse never come past her lips. I do remember, Mama. I remember she lying in bed, right there, a man standing in the door. She say, Esdras, I put a curse on your head. You worsen tomorrow. How come she said like that? Gomorrah. I believe Gomorrah, she said. She know the Bible inside out. Did she live with you? No, she visited. She come up to see us all, her children, how we doing. She come up to see sights, then she lay down and died. She was old. I remained quiet because of the death of mothers. Mrs. Luddy looked at me thoughtfully, then she said, my mama had stories to tell. She raised me on. Her mama was a little thing. No sense. Standing in the door of the cabin all day, sucking her thumb. It was slave times. One day, a young field boy comes storming along. He knock on the door of the first cabin, hollering, sister, come out. It's freedom. She come out. She say, yeah, when? He say, now. It's freedom now. Then he knock at the next door and say, sister, it's freedom now. From one cabin, he run to the next cabin, crying out, sister, it's freedom now. Oh, I remember that story, said Donald. Freedom now, freedom now. He jumped up and down. You don't remember nothing, boy. Go on, get Eloise. She want to get into the good times. Eloise was 2, but undersized. We got her like that, said Donald. Mrs. Luddy let me buy her ice cream and green vegetables. She was waiting for kale and chard, but it was too early. The kale liked cold. You're not about to be here in November, she said. No. I turned away. Lonesomeness touching me, and sang our Eloise song. Eloise loves the bees they buzz like Eloise does. Then Eloise crawled all over the splintery floor, buzzing wildly. Oh, you crazy baby, said Donald. Buzz, 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 buzz. Mrs. Luddy sat down by the window. Y'all make a lot of noise, she said sadly. You're just right on noisy. The next morning, Mrs. Luddy woke me up. Time to go, she said. What? Home. What? I said. Well, don't you think your little spoiled boy's crying for you? Where's Mama? They standing in the window. Time to go, lady. This ain't free vacation farm. Time we was by ourselves a little. Oh, Ma, said Donald, she ain't a lot of trouble. Go on. Get Eloise. She hollering and button up your lip. She didn't offer me coffee. She looked at me strictly all the time. I tried to look strictly back, but I failed. Because I love the sight of her. Donald was teary, but I didn't dare turn my face to him until the parting minute at the door. Even then, I kissed the top of his head a little too forcefully and said, well, see ya. On the front stoop, there were about half a dozen mid-morning family people and kids arguing about who had dumped garbage out of which window. They were very disgusted with one another. Two young men in handsome dashikis stood in council and agreement at the street corner. They divided a comment. How come white women's got rotten teeth? And look so old. A young woman waiting at the light said, hush. I walked past them and didn't begin my run till the road opened up somewhere along Ocean Parkway. I was a little stiff because my way of life had used only small movements, an occasional stretch to put a knife or teapot out of the reach of the babies. I ran about 10, 15 blocks, then my second wind came, which is classical. Famous among runners, it's the beginning of flying. In the 3 weeks I'd been off the street, jogging had become popular. It seemed that I was only one person doing her thing, which happened, like most American eccentric acts, to be the most in thing I could have done. In fact, two young men ran alongside of me for nearly a mile. They ran silently beside me and turned off at Avenue H. A gentleman with a mustache running poorly in the opposite direction waved. He called out, hi, senora. Near home, I ran through our park where I had aired my children on weekends and late summer afternoons. I stopped at the Northeast playground where I met a dozen young mothers intelligently handling their little ones. In order to prepare them, meaning no harm, I said, in 15 years, you girls will be like me, wrong in everything. At home, it was Saturday morning. Jack had returned, looking as grim as ever, but he brought cash and a vacuum cleaner. While the coffee perked, he showed Richard how to use it. They were playing tic-tac-toe on the dusty wall. Richard said, well, look who's here. Hi. Any news? I asked. Letter from Daddy, he said, from the lake and water country in Chile. He says it's like Minnesota. He's never been to Minnesota, I said. Where's Anthony? Here I am, said Tonto, appearing. But I'm leaving. Oh, yes, I said, of course. Every Saturday, he hurries through breakfast or misses it. He goes to visit his friends in institutions. These are well-known places like Bellevue, Hillside, Rockland State, Central Islip, Manhattan. These visits take him all day and sometimes half the night. I found some chocolate chip cookies in the pantry. Take them, Tonto, I said. Remember, I remembered nearly all his friends as little boys and girls, hopping, skipping, jumping, cookie eating. He was annoyed. He said, no, chocolate cookies is what the commissaries are full of. How about money? Jack dropped the vacuum cleaner. He said, no, they have parents for that. I said, here, $5 for cigarettes, $1 each. Cigarettes, said Jack. God damn it. Black lungs and death, cancer, emphysema. He stomped out of the kitchen, breathing. He took the bike from the back room and started for Central Park, which has been closed to cars but open to bicycle riders. When he'd been gone about 10 minutes, Anthony said, it's really open only on Sundays. Why didn't you say so? Why can't you be decent to him, I asked. It's important to me. Oh, Faith, he said, patting me on the head because he'd grown so tall. All that air, it's good for his lungs and his muscles. He'll be back soon. You should ride, too, I said. You don't want to get mushy in your legs. You should go swimming once a week. I'm too busy, he said. I have to see my friends. Then Richard, who had been vacuuming under his bed, came into the kitchen. You still here, Tonto? Going, going, gone, said Anthony. Don't bat your eye. Now listen, Richard said. Here's a note. It's for Judy. If you get as far as Rockland,
Don't forget it. Don't open it. Don't read it. I know he'll read it. Anthony smiled and slammed the door. Did I lose weight? I asked.
Yes, said Richard. You look okay.
You never look too bad, but where were you? I got sick of Raftery's boiled potatoes. Where were you, Faith?
Well, I said. Well, I stayed a few weeks in my old apartment, where Grandpa and Grandma and me and Hope and Charlie lived when we were little. I took you there, long ago, not so far from the ocean, where Grandma made us very healthy with sun and air. What are you talking about? Said Richard. Cut the baby talk. Anthony came home earlier than expected that evening because some people were in shock therapy and someone else had run away. He listened to me for a while, then he said, I don't know what she's talking about either. Neither did Jack. Despite the understanding often produced by love after absence, he said, tell me again. He was in a good mood. He said, you can even tell it to me twice. I repeated the story. They all said, what? Because it isn't usually so simple. Have you known it to happen much nowadays? A woman inside the steamy energy of middle age runs and runs. She finds the houses and streets where her childhood happened. She lives in them. She learns, as though she was still a child, what in the world is coming next.
Laura Esterman read Grace Paley's The Long Distance Runner. If you like listening to short stories and have always wondered whether you could write one, you could enter our annual Stella Kupferberg Memorial Short Story Prize Contest. You can learn all about the contest, its deadlines, and its prize by going to our website, selectedshorts.org. We'll be back in a minute with another terrific Paley story. You're listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, the second of our Grace Paley picks, and our Ave Atque Vale to our dear friend Grace is her poignant story, A Conversation with My Father. The reader is the actress who starred in the Broadway drama Night Mother, Anne Petoniak.
My father is 86 years old and in bed. His heart, that bloody motor, is equally old and will not do certain jobs anymore. It still floods his head with brainy light, but it won't let his legs carry the weight of his body around the house. Despite my metaphors, this muscle failure is not due to his old heart, he says, but to a potassium shortage. Sitting on one pillow, leaning on three, he offers last-minute advice and makes a request. I would like you to write a simple story just once more, he says. The kind Maupassant wrote, or Chekhov, the kind you used to write. Just recognizable people, and then write down what happened to them next. I say, yes, why not? That's possible. I want to please him, though I don't remember writing that way. I would like to try to tell such a story, if he means the kind that begins, there was a woman followed by plot. The absolute line between two points which I've always despised. Not for literary reasons, but because it takes all hope away. Everyone, real or invented, deserves the open destiny of life. Finally, I thought of a story that had been happening for a couple of years right across the street. I wrote it down, then read it aloud. Pa, I said, How about this? Do you mean something like this? Once in my time, there was a woman and she had a son. They lived nicely in a small apartment in Manhattan. This boy, at about 15, became a junkie, which is not unusual in our neighborhood. In order to maintain her close friendship with him, she became a junkie, too. She said it was part of the youth culture with which she felt very much at home. After a while, for a number of reasons, the boy gave it all up and left the city and his mother in disgust. Hopeless and alone, she grieved. We all visit her. "Okay, Pa, that's it," I said. "An unadorned and miserable tale." "But that's not what I mean," my father said. "You misunderstood me on purpose. You know there's a lot more to it than that. You know that. You left everything out. Turgenev wouldn't do that. Chekhov wouldn't do that. There are, in fact, Russian writers you never heard of, you don't have an inkling of, as good as anyone, who can write a plain, ordinary story, who would not leave out what you have left out." "I object not to facts, but to people sitting in trees, talking senselessly, voices from who knows where." "Forget that one, Pa." "What have I left out now, in this one? Her looks, for instance." "Oh, quite handsome, I think." "Yes." "Her hair? Dark, with heavy braids, as though she were a girl or a foreigner." "What were her parents like? Her stock? That she became such a person. It's interesting, you know." From out of town, professional people. The first to be divorced in their county. How's that?" "Enough?" I asked. "With you, it's all a joke," he said. "What about the boy's father? Why didn't you mention him? Who was he? Or was the boy born out of wedlock?" "Yes," I said. "He was born out of wedlock." "For God's sakes, doesn't anyone in your stories get married? Doesn't anyone have time to run down to City Hall before they jump into bed?" "No," I said. "In real life, yes. But in my stories, no." "Why do you answer me like that?" "Oh, Pa, this is a simple story about a smart woman who came to NYC full of interest, love, trust, excitement, very up to date, and about her son. What a hard time she had in this world. Married or not, it's of small consequence." "It is of great consequence," he said. "Okay," I said. "Okay, okay yourself," he said. "But listen, I believe you, she's good looking, but I don't think she was so smart." "That's true," I said. "Actually, that's the trouble with stories. People start out fantastic. You think they're extraordinary. But it turns out as the work goes along, they're just average with a good education. Sometimes the other way around. The person's a kind of dumb innocent, but he outwits you and you can't even think of an ending good enough." "What do you do then?" he asked. He had been a doctor for a couple of decades and then an artist for a couple of decades. And he's still interested in details, craft, technique. "Well, you just have to let the story lie around until some agreement can be reached between you and the stubborn hero." "Aren't you talking silly now?" he said. "Start again," he said. "So happens I'm not going out this evening. Tell the story again. See what you can do this time." "Okay," I said. "But it's not a 5-minute job." Second attempt. "Once, across the street from us, there was a fine, handsome woman, our neighbor. She had a son whom she loved, and she'd known him since birth. In helpless, chubby infancy, and in the wrestling, hugging ages, 7 to 10, as well as earlier and later. This boy, when he fell into the fist of adolescence, became a junkie. He was not a hopeless one. He was, in fact, hopeful, an ideologue, and successful converter. With his busy brilliance, he wrote persuasive articles for his high school newspaper. Seeking a wider audience, using important connections, he drummed into Lower Manhattan newsstand distribution a periodical called Oh, Golden Horse. In order to keep him from feeling guilty, because guilt is the stony heart of 9/10 of all clinically diagnosed cancers in America today, she said, And because she'd always believed in giving bad habits room at home where one could keep an eye on them, she too became a junkie. Her kitchen was famous for a while, a center for intellectual addicts who knew what they were doing. A few felt artistic, like Coleridge, and others were scientific and revolutionary, like Leary. Although she was often high herself, certain good mothering reflexes remained, and she saw to it that there was lots of orange juice around, and honey, and milk, and vitamin pills. However, she never cooked anything but chili, and that no more than once a week. She explained, when we talked to her seriously, with neighborly concern, that it was her part in the youth culture, and she would rather be with the young, it was an honor, than with her own generation. One week, while nodding through an Antonioni film, this boy was severely jabbed by the elbow of a stern and proselytizing girl sitting beside him. She offered immediate apricots and nuts for his sugar level, spoke to him sharply, and took him home. She had heard of him and his work, and she herself published, edited, and wrote a competitive journal called Man Does Live by Bread Alone. In the organic heat of her continuous presence, he could not help but become interested once more in his muscles, his arteries, and nerve connections. In fact, he began to love them, treasure them, praise them with funny little songs in Man Does Live. The fingers of my flesh transcend my transcendental soul. The tightness in my shoulders end. My teeth have made me whole. To the mouth of his head, that glory of will and determination, he brought hard apples, nuts, wheat germ, and soybean oil. He said to his old friends, "From now on, I guess I'll keep my wits about me. I'm going on the natch." He said he was about to begin a spiritual deep breathing journey. "How about you too, Mom?" he asked kindly. His conversion was so radiant, splendid, that neighborhood kids his age began to say he had never been a real addict at all, only a journalist along for the smell of a story. And the mother tried several times to give up what had become, without her son and his friends, a lonely habit. This effort only brought it to supportable levels. The boy and his girl took their electronic mimeograph and moved to the bushy edge of another burrow. They were very strict. They said they would not see her again until she'd been off drugs for 60 days. At home, alone in the evening, weeping, the mother read and reread the 7 issues of O Golden Horse. They seemed to her as truthful as ever. We often crossed the street to visit and console. But if we mentioned any of our children who were at college or in the hospital or dropouts at home, she would cry out, "My baby, my baby," and burst into terrible, face-scarring, time-consuming tears. The end. First, my father was silent, and then he said, "Number 1, you have a nice sense of humor. 2, I see you can't tell a plain story, so don't waste time." And then he said sadly, "Number 3, I suppose that means she was alone. She was left like that, his mother. Alone. Probably sick." I said, "Yes." "Poor woman. Poor girl to be born in a time of fools, to live among fools. The end. The end. You were right to put that down. The end." I didn't want to argue, but I had to say, "Well, it's not necessarily the end, Pa." "Yes," he said. "What a tragedy. The end of a person." "No, Pa," I begged him. "It doesn't have to be. She's only about 40. She could be 100 different things in this world as time goes on. A teacher or a social worker, an ex-junkie. Sometimes it's better than having a master's in education." "Jokes," he said. "As a writer, that's your main trouble. You don't want to recognize it. Tragedy, plain tragedy, historical tragedy. No hope, the end." "Oh, Pa," I said, "she could change. And your own life, too, you have to look it in the face. He took a couple of nitroglycerin. Turn to 5, he said, pointing to the dial on the oxygen tank. He inserted the tubes into his nostrils and breathed deep. He closed his eyes and said, "No. I had promised the family to always let him have the last word when arguing, but in this case I had a different responsibility. That woman lives across the street. She's my knowledge and my invention. I'm sorry for her. I'm not going to leave her there in that house crying. Actually, neither would life, which, unlike me, has no pity. Therefore, she did change. Of course, her son never came home again, but right now, she's a receptionist in a storefront community clinic in the East Village. Most of the customers are young people, some old friends. The head doctor has said to her, 'If we only had 3 people in this clinic with your experiences.' The doctor said that. My father took the oxygen tubes out of his nostrils and said, 'Jokes. Jokes again.' 'No, Pa. It could really happen that way. It's a funny world nowadays.' 'No,' he said. 'Truth first. She will slide back. A person must have character. She does not.' 'No, Pa,' I said. 'That's it. She's got a job. Forget it. She's in the storefront working.' 'How long will it be?' he said. Tragedy. You too. When will you look it in the face?
A Conversation with My Father by Grace Paley, read by Ann Petoniak. If you've enjoyed hearing this conversation with a father, you might like to know about our selected short CD collection, Family Matters, which includes another story of Grace Paley's. You can find out all about it by going to selectedshorts.org. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague, and our production assistant is Miranda Schaefer. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Our theme music is Roger Calloway's Come to the Meadow. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of The Best American Short Stories, edited in 2008 by Salman Rushdie, and by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is provided by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, Budget Travel, the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art, the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency, the Henry Nias Foundation, and the Lila Atchison Wallace Theater Fund of the New York Community Trust. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York, and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.